Welcome, everybody, to Studio 2 on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Avi Wolf-Manarin.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. Happy Tuesday.
Happy Tuesday.
But Wednesday
could
be a different type of day. As mentioned, you heard on NPR, we are T-minus about 36 hours until President Donald Trump's tariffs kick in at midnight Wednesday night, dubbed Liberation Day. These reciprocal tariffs, according to the president, will reduce American reliance on foreign goods. The scope of these tariffs are thought to be sweeping and would include a 25% levy on imported automobiles and auto parts, and they're expected to raise the cost of electronics, metals, lumber, pharmaceuticals, and the list goes on. A lot is still unknown, but, you know, consumers are worried. Inflationary prices could get even more inflated, and business owners are worried. The markets are jittery. We've seen it all. And critics wonder if the tariffs would even work. And so today, that's what we're going to talk about. We have an expert in studio. We'll talk about how we got here, free trade, all those things. And we'll look at the impact that these tariffs could have. And our question for you, our listeners, is this. Would you be willing to pay more for goods like cars, seafood, medicine, produce, all those things, if it meant more American jobs in the long run? Or
trade-offs.
Is it just all too much? And you're like, no, 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 no. Give us your logic. Call us 888-477-9499. You can email studio2 at whyy.org. And if you're watching on YouTube, hi, YouTubers, studio tubers there. Be sure to leave your comments in the chat.
Talking tariffs today. But first, a trio of local news stories, Cherry, as we always do at the start of the show. And we're going to start down in Washington, specifically the floor of the U.S. Senate, where New Jersey Senator Cory Booker has been speaking for about 17 hours now. He took the floor last night at 7 p.m. He has not relinquished the floor. He says he is going to talk as long as he is physically capable of talking. What is the theme of the speech? Well, with any 17-hour speech, there are many themes, but the basic organizing principle is Trump bad. He has criticized lots of things the Trump administration is doing, including moves that he says have been terrible for the economy. Let's hear a clip.
If you ask the question, are you better off than you were 71 days ago? Not many Americans would say they're better off. Their costs are higher. Their groceries are higher. They're soon to see everything from car prices to food go higher. If you ask the question, are you better off than you?
All right. There you go.
Yeah.
Well, higher costs. That's the theme of today's show.
That is. That is. And I mean, I asked myself, did Senator Booker hear our recent show where we heard from?
Oh, let's assume he did. Yeah.
Yeah. Let's assume he was listening to Studio 2.
As he always does.
Where we had many of our listeners call in and say, Democrats, do something.
Right.
Right. Fight back. I mean, and this wasn't, you know, technically this wasn't a filibuster because they weren't debating a particular bill.
Sure.
But it still is disrupting the business of the Senate right now. And Democrats have said, I mean, I can't even remember the woman's name who was so...
Marisol.
Yeah, Marisol. Like, she was like, do something, fight back. And this is the kind of good trouble that the late, great Congressman John Lewis talked about and Senator Booker talked about in his long 17-hour speech. But, I mean, they want to see some kind of fight, even if it doesn't mean that they can take down a law. But that's what the Democrats said they wanted to see. And this is an example of it.
You know, they say, like, there's no bad ideas and brainstorming. Like, that's the stage the Democrats are at right now. Your approval ratings are really, really low. Just try something.
Yeah.
And I will note that Cory Booker is not just someone trying something. He has kind of been appointed the leader of the Senate Democrats on messaging and communication. So he's supposed to be spearheading the rhetorical strategic response to Trump, not as much the legislative, but like the messaging part of it. And this has at least broken through. You could say that at bare minimum.
We're talking about it.
We're talking about it. You know, what's step two after step one here? I have no idea, right? I don't know. So you stay up there as long as you can, but it has broken through the noise. So at least on that level, I would say it's been a success. It got all of our attention.
And we'll talk about successes and wins and losses, and we'll fly on over in our Studio 2 ship and to I made this up.
We're in an Airbus, I think. We're like in a blimp.
Oh, yeah. I like that. That's actually
the
good
Studio
visual.
Studio 2 blimp. Where are we flying?
We're flying over to a tiny block in Fishtown.
Oh, let's land the blimp. Okay.
This tiny block is not wide. Was not wide enough to qualify.
Our blimp doesn't fit on the block. It's too small.
It's so tiny. It wasn't wide enough to qualify for a city sponsored speed bump. So the neighbors decided to set up and create their own speed bump.
These people said, you're not going to give us a speed bump on our block in Fishtown. We're making our own.
We're going to make our own speed bump. There you go, city. Okay. And the street in question is the 1200 block of Cree Street. It's a tight one-way street. And apparently there are 20 children under age 18 that live on that street. And parents were concerned about their children's safety. So they took matters into their own hand. They purchased removable speed bumps and put them on the ends of the block. And it seemed to work. You know, the seniors on the block, the parents with the kiddos, they all thought, yes, I feel safer. But then somebody complained to the police. Okay.
311.
Yes. And they,
or
and
it was 911, I guess. Yeah.
And it led to the removal of the speed bumps. And, you know, in February. And so now the concern is that, look, they won't be able to deal with the traffic calming measures. And I mean, you know, Philly has this broader traffic calming initiative, but, you know, they can't get to everywhere. And so I say kudos to this block.
Wait.
But at the same time, it probably could have caused some issues. And I could see, you know, people complaining. But go ahead.
Let's be fair and balanced here.
Yes, I'm balanced.
Because I am truly torn on this story. First of all, shout out to the Inquirer who unearthed this story about this.
Pretty good
this,
one, too.
Yeah, this block in Fishtown taking matters into their own hands. On the one hand, it's a very bad precedent to let every block in Philadelphia decide what they want to do with traffic and cars. Because that is how you end up in parking cone land, right? People just sort of doing whatever they want, take, you know, their own ad hoc solutions. At the same time, let me say unequivocally, I love living on a small one-way street in Philadelphia. It is life-changing, and having limited amounts of traffic and traffic that moves very, very slowly really does improve your quality of life. Like, I will stand on that. Mm-hmm. And I totally understand why people would want to implement that. And I don't quite understand why the city has a width requirement for speed
if
bumps.
People can speed down, if it's wide enough
if
to
it's
speed,
wide enough to speed, why not? Like, I live on a block that's not wide enough to speed. And again, let me tell you, it is life-changing. Mm-hmm. Like, if you can find a small block in Philly, go there, move there. It's awesome. But I don't understand why there would be a width requirement that's so wide that you could still speed down it.
Yeah.
So I think the city has some questions to answer here as well.
A lot of questions to be answered. And people, you know, this is a real thing in Philly. People get hit, you know, pedestrians, bikers, all that. And so people are concerned.
Absolutely. No, but there's a real issue at the heart of this.
But we're going to go from tiny blocks to the tiny desk.
Oh, wow. Were you setting that up?
I've been thinking about this all morning.
Well, let me just stop and clap.
Thank you. You're usually the transition person.
Great transition. So we're taking the blimp back to DC now. So you guys know NPR's Tiny Desk, and it's just it's a really important platform for launching musicians.
Mm-hmm.
And today there's a new episode of the Tiny Desk that just dropped, and it features an up and coming Philly born rapper who is named Chocolate Droppa.
Droppa.
So let's hear a drop from Chocolate Droppa on the Tiny Desk.
Like a wolf, I got big teeth. Like a wolf, I wanna eat. Like a wolf, I'm on the prowl. Like a wolf, I'm gonna growl. Ah, I'm biting, I'm fighting. I'm scrappy because I'm just like lightning.
So that is a Chocolate Droppa. And I'm just gonna note this for legal reasons. That Chocolate Droppa bears a very strong resemblance to Philly-born comedian Kevin Hart.
Yes, I
very
squinted
strong.
And I was like, I think I know him.
And I will also note, again, just for legal reasons, that today is April 1st. But do you have thoughts on Chocolate Droppa? Obviously, very hot new Philly rapper. And I really like that verse. I don't know how you
I like that verse, too. I want to rah, rah, too, you know?
You know I love a wolf theme. Lil Wolfie loves a wolf
theme. I know. Lil Wolfie got to come back. We got to resurrect Lil Wolfie. But, you know, I really liked it. There were several songs. And the Band of Brothers. Brand of Brothers.
Yeah.
Just like Droppa.
Yeah.
And apparently, you know, Chocolate Droppa met these these musicians outside of the Tiny Desk and brought him in.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
I think he's got a bright future. Love Chocolate Droppa. Mm-hmm. We did ask each other if there was another Philly-born non-musician mm-hmm. to play the Tiny Desk, who would they be and what would their act be? And I know you prepared some, I prepared some.
Yes.
Go ahead.
I said MC Mac Attack.
Who's that?
A.K.A. Charlie Mack, longtime security guard for Will Smith.
Yep.
His band would be First Out of the Limo, and his his debut song would be Backstage Passes and Dark Glasses.
Wow, that's way more involved than what I prepared. Okay, so I have a band. This is a doo-wop group mm-hmm. playing the Tiny Desk called Jim Gardner and His Gnomes.
Oh, that's so good.
Yeah, a little Yeah. And then I also came up with an art rock band called Noam Chomsky and the Lingual Jingles. All right, never mind. That one didn't take off. Okay.
But I love the Jim Gardner. Like,
you like the Jim Gardner?
I think people would really go see Jim.
Yeah, Jim Gardner and his gnomes. I don't know if Jim can sing, but you know.
Yeah.
There's something there. That transition means our producers want us to move on. So
and
let's
we'll
turn
do that.
Let's turn now to our main topic today, which is tariffs. President Trump is expected to unveil his tariff plan tomorrow, which he has dubbed Liberation Day. Now, he's already put levies on aluminum, steel, and other goods from Canada, Mexico, and China, and a 25% tariff on foreign-made cars goes into effect Wednesday.
The intention behind the tariffs, according to the president, is to bring jobs and manufacturing back to America. But many economists worry that tariffs will hurt business, consumers, and drag down the economy. We've already seen lots of jitters in the market. So today, we want to discuss the possible effects on Americans and ask, have we let free trade go unchecked for too long?
With us in studio is Jonathan Doe, professor of international business at Villanova and a former official at the U.S. Department of Commerce. Jonathan, welcome to Studio 2.
Happy to be with you, Ari and Cherry.
Yes, and I want to invite our listeners at home to join the conversation as well. Would you be willing to pay more for goods like cars, groceries, or produce if it would bring more jobs back to America in the long run? You can call 888-477-9499. You can email studio2@whyy.org. And for our Studio Tubers online, be sure to put your comments in the YouTube live chat. Avi?
Gregory from Philadelphia says there is zero reason to believe these tariffs will lead to more U.S. jobs. So let's put a pin in that for a second. Mm. And Jonathan, quick and dirty history. What was the state of global trade, hemispheric trade before NAFTA? Because NAFTA is often thought of as like the watershed moment, the North American Free Trade Agreement. So what was it like before then? Were they putting tons of taxes and tariffs and everything coming in and out of the U.S.?
No, not exactly.
Okay.
Prior to World War II, there was a period where there was a kind of a trade war, tariff war. But in the post-World War II period, there was a long period of gradual declining tariffs and deepening economic integration around the world. This is a period where we had global trade agreements going into effect and regional trade agreements like NAFTA. So there really was a long period in which
so trade— sort of building up to that.
Absolutely. Trade becoming freer and economies more integrated.
So at that same time, many people, I think, would know or at least believe that over that same period of time, so end of World War II up through the end of the century, there was a decline in American manufacturing and a certain type of work, the sort of the idea you worked at the same factory for 30 years, got your pension, etc. Are those two things tied together?
They may be. The decline in U.S. manufacturing, though, I think can be sourced to a number of different influences, notably the advance of technology.
Yeah.
And trying to tease apart what is attributable to trade versus technology is difficult. When I travel around the world with my students, we often go to auto factories, and we don't see a lot of people in those factories. We see a lot of robots.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that's been a worldwide trend.
So it's automation, it's free trade, all of those things sort of led to the decline in American manufacturing.
Absolutely.
I want to get a general understanding of tariffs. Like, so what are they and how have they been used pre-Trump to sort of affect domestic commerce?
Yeah, tariffs are taxes, plain and simple. Nothing more complicated than that. But they're taxes that are collected at the border on imports. And the question often comes about who pays. Who pays for those tariffs? And we pay for those tariffs in one form or another. Either the importing company itself pays, or they pass on the cost to consumers, or typically some combination of the two. Tariffs have been part of global economic history for many centuries. And we've had period where countries have imposed high tariffs, as seems to be the case now. In the UK in the 1800s, there was something called the corn tax.
Corn tax.
Yeah, so there was a series of taxes placed on corn, and there was a global trade war. It didn't end well. In the 1930s, there was something called the Smoot-Hawley tariff that also initiated a series of tit-for-tat global trade wars, and that was thought to contribute to the worsening of the Great Depression. Mm-hmm. So we have had periods of tariff and trade wars such as this, and in general, we would say they haven't gone in a very good direction.
And so those are the trade war moments. But how have they generally been used by presidents to sort just before Trump? Because I know that they said Biden used tariffs, other presidents used tariffs, but I think a lot of people don't really pay attention. And now tariff is all we're talking about.
So it's a great question. Are tariffs now and in the past being used to rearrange economic relationships? Are they being used to gain leverage to try to get other countries to do something we want them to do? I think the latter justification is, you know, quite normal and acceptable. We might use our negotiating leverage as a way to extract concessions from other countries. Using tariffs to try to rearrange both domestic and global economies, I think, is a more questionable tactic.
And that's what you think? That's what Trump is doing?
Not clear. It's not clear because in some cases, with respect to Canada and Mexico, we have particular issues around immigration, around fentanyl, and the idea was to use the tariffs to extract more commitments on the part of those two countries to tackle those problems. In other cases, it does seem like there's the goal of rearranging economic relationships such that more foreign companies will invest in the U.S. and produce here as opposed to produce and sell as exports into our market.
What about sort of the Trump logic that we're being taken advantage of, that people are putting tariffs on our exports, but we're not doing the reciprocal thing when we import their goods?
It is true that we have lower tariffs than many countries around the world. And some would say we can afford to have lower tariffs because we have such a strong and robust economy. But a trade deficit in and of itself is not necessarily a bad thing. All that means is we consume more than we produce. And we happen to have a very consumption-focused economy, and that means we're going to consume a lot of domestic goods. We're going to consume a lot of imported goods as well.
What's the advantage of a consumption-focused economy, and what are the drawbacks?
The advantage of it is that we live a very wealthy, bountiful lifestyle. The
downside, we can afford lots of stuff.
We can afford lots of stuff, and we buy lots of stuff. I don't know how many times a week you go on Amazon. I probably go more than I should. But the downside is we don't save as much as we should, and we need to borrow from abroad in order to make up that deficit. And that's the way our economy has been structured for some period of time. We run high debts and deficits, both individually, companies and governments, and we spend a lot of money. And the trade deficit, the fact that we import more than we export, is a direct consequence of that.
And President Donald Trump has said we have to get off the sauce, so to speak, and it's going to hurt. Is it time? I mean, people have said, we've talked about free trade a little bit at the start of this conversation. It's been a problem. We've lost so many jobs. Is tariffs the way? Are tariffs the way to get off the sauce?
It's a complicated question. I'll try to break it down. So certainly if tariffs are imposed on imports of products over a long period of time, that does provide an incentive for foreign companies to invest here. We're a very large, rich economy. Companies want to do business here. They want to sell products. But if tariffs are used in a less calculated way, a less strategic way, it may not really have that long-term effect and may have significant short-term disruptions, notably inflation. So costs go up because we are not importing as much. And our domestic companies don't have that import competition to keep them honest and keep their prices low. In the longer term, it could be people start to buy less because as those prices go up, they don't want to go to the market anymore. And that could lead to slowing economy, a recession.
All right. So we've just done tariffs 101 with Jonathan Doe, yes, which is a great start. I'm going to read in a few more comments and then we're going to go to a break. And on the other side of the break, we're going to get a little bit more into the back and forth, the debate around tariffs and free trade. So speaking of comments, let me read this one from Matt in Norristown, one of our regulars, who says, Trump tariffs are a disaster. Who could have guessed that a guy who declared bankruptcy five times doesn't understand how economics works? Monique is critical of the tariffs and asks, would the jobs guarantee a livable wage? So that's another question we can ask on the other side of the break. And KA says, there's a reason that jobs left the U.S. If you bring them back, you're going to pay more anyway, unless we go back to slave labor or slave wages. Keep those comments coming. Studio2@whyy.org or call 888-477-9499. Stick with us. You are listening to Studio 2. And with that, we are back here on Studio 2. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt, and today we're talking about the tariffs that the Trump administration is expected to announce tomorrow. There's already a 25% tariff on cars that goes into effect tomorrow, and now the president has signaled that he'll add reciprocal tariffs on goods from, quote, all countries. We've been talking with Jonathan Doe, professor of international business at Villanova and a former Commerce Department official, about tariffs and the idea of free trade.
Yes, and I'm Cherry Gregg, by the way, but we want to now bring in Ray Jensen, assistant director for the United Auto Workers Region 9, to get his take on Trump's move to apply tariffs to foreign-made cars. Ray, welcome to Studio 2.
Good afternoon. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, and again, to our listeners at home or on YouTube, our question for you is, would you be more willing to pay more, or should I say, would you be willing to pay more for goods like cars, groceries, produce, if it would bring more jobs back to America in the long run? The number is 888-477-9499. You can email studio2@whyy.org. And for those of you watching on YouTube, be sure to leave your comment in the chat.
So, Ray, I take it that you are supportive of the idea of tariffs specifically on cars and car parts. So first of all, is that true? And if so, walk us through your logic.
So yeah, we in the UAW know that we've suffered from broken trade laws and anti-worker trade laws for years and for decades. We've seen good paying manufacturing jobs leave this country by the tens of thousands. Since 2003, the big three alone has closed 65 plants here in the U.S. So we are supportive of anything that will bring good-paying manufacturing jobs back to this country and support our members. We will support policies that support the worker.
Now, some folks say, look, it would take years for those jobs to come, and we might even be chasing ghosts. What do you say in response to that argument?
Look, we have to start somewhere, right? If we continue on this cycle that we're on, we're not going to have any jobs in this country. These companies are allowed to move product and jobs overseas and into other countries, and then they exploit those workers. For example, the Mexican auto workers make $5 to $6 an hour in the assembly plants.
So, Ray, another argument against these tariffs would be, well, you might bring some jobs back, but the wage that goes with that job is less impactful because you're now paying more for all sorts of products. You're paying more for your car. You're paying more for food. You're paying more for energy. What do you say to someone who says, yeah, you might bring a job back, but all of a sudden that job's not worth as much anymore?
So I'll give you an example. General Motors builds the Chevy Silverado in Fort Wayne, and they also build the Chevy Silverado in Mexico. The only way to tell the difference on those vehicles is from the VIN number. If it has the 3, it was made in Mexico. But if the consumer goes to a dealership and doesn't know that, and you look at the sticker price on those vehicles, they're the same exact price, except the workers in Mexico are making $5 to $6 an hour. So the only one getting rich is the companies and the corporations.
So you're saying the prices of things would not go up?
The prices of things might go up, but General Motors made $15 billion last year in profit. There was a way for them to absorb the cost instead of pushing it off on the American consumer like they did during COVID. We saw what happened during COVID when the price of new vehicles went up 40 to 50%. Why? Because they could. They took advantage of a global pandemic.
So real quick, though, how would you compel, though, General Motors, Ford, or whomever to not pocket the profit if indeed that's what they're doing, right? Because they could still continue to do that, and they could raise prices.
Well, we know that they pay their CEOs very well. We know that they pay their stockholders very well, and they do stock buybacks all the time. Bring these jobs back to the U.S. There's factories here that I'm sure they could have capacity to build some of the products that they build in Mexico and build it here in the U.S. and like I said, we have to start somewhere. Otherwise, we're going to be on a downward cycle, and we'll be at a race to the bottom.
Yeah. And so I talked to the American consumer who in a couple of months is, you know, young mom, maybe a young couple, three kids, and they gotta buy a car in June. And what is your argument to them when they can't afford the different price?
Don't be mad at the union for trying to protect the workers. Be mad at the corporations for trying to price gouge the American consumer.
Well, there you have it. That's Ray Jensen, Assistant Director for the United Auto Workers Region 9. Ray, really appreciate your time today on Studio 2.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
So you heard that, Jonathan Doe. I mean, basically what Ray's saying is we don't have to raise prices here. We just need the people at the top to take a little bit less. And we could sort of have both. We could have jobs here and we could still have cheap goods.
So outside of my area of expertise or comment is how much CEOs should or should not make. But with respect to trade, the truth is that our auto industry is already deeply integrated with Canada and Mexico. This is something from the New York Times a week or so ago that shows this Toyota RAV4, which is imported from Canada, has 70% of its content from U.S. and Canada, and just 30% from outside North America. Whereas this Nissan Rogue, purportedly made in the United States, gets more than half of its content from Japan and another 30% from other countries. It's almost impossible to determine, you know, what is a North American or a U.S. vehicle versus a Canadian or Mexican or even a vehicle imported from further away.
Because cars consist of many components, many materials, and it's all moving around the world all the time.
They do, and especially North America, because since 1965, we've had this auto pact with Canada that is free trade between those two countries. Then we began bringing Mexico into the mix, and that was essentially codified with the NAFTA from 1994.
But I wonder, like, if you think about, you know, American-made vehicles, President Trump said he could care less, you know, if the price of foreign cars went up because it would force Americans to buy American. But you're saying that even American cars are not all American.
Yeah, I think it's very difficult to discern, you know, what is a North American car or what is a U.S. versus a Canadian versus a Mexican car for these reasons I mentioned.
So would this sort of impact even the quote American manufacturers, the pricing of those cars as well?
It would. And the stated policy is to only tax the non-American portions of those imports. I don't know how they're going to do that. I think just administratively, that's almost an impossibility. So there's a question about the economic impact of these tariffs. There's also a question about the practicality of them. You know, can they accomplish what they're seeking to accomplish?
What I heard Ray Jensen saying, though, is that, yes, we have a very interconnected world. This is all very complicated. But you have to start somewhere. You have to do something. How would you address that? I mean, he's not saying this is the only solution. He's saying this is a tool. We have to start to use it. And then we go from there.
I agree. I think that trade and integration should come along with other kinds of cooperation and other kinds of commitments. And that's why in the NAFTA, we had a labor agreement and an environment agreement that sat alongside the trade agreement. It's also why when President Trump renegotiated the NAFTA as the USMCA, that there was a requirement that in order to qualify for this duty-free treatment in North America for automotive parts and finished vehicles, they needed to add 75% of their value in North America, and 40% of that production had to come from factories where workers made $16 or more per hour. So there have been efforts to try
to... So those are the guardrails that are in there.
Exactly.
Now.
Are they sufficient? Probably not. But there are other aspects of guardrails between and among countries that we might not like either. We might not like Canada or Mexico or other countries kind of dictating how we do business here. So it's hard for us to dictate necessarily how they do business there. There are concerns about wage differentials between countries around the world. And these are real concerns and they have real impacts.
Yeah, and that's sort of what Ray was talking about. By the way, we've heard some of the reaction from some of the countries, and in particular Canada. The Canadian Prime Minister Mark Carney told reporters last week that Canada's old relationship with the United States was over and that Canada has the right to fight back with retaliatory measures. Take a listen to what he had to say.
I reject any attempts to weaken Canada, to wear us down, to break us so that America can own us. That will never happen. And our response to these latest tariffs is to fight, is to protect, and to build.
And so can we just zoom out from the, you know, auto tariffs that go into effect on Wednesday to some of the other tariffs? I mean, we used to have this very, and prior to the auto relationship, we got a lot of stuff from Canada. We got a lot of stuff from Mexico. And now one of our best trading partners is in war stance, in trade war stance. Can you talk about what, how will these tariffs sort of impact those relationships? And I know we get a lot of Canadian goods, we get a lot of Mexican goods. Can you talk about the impact a little bit?
Yeah, so there's the economic impact of the disruption of no longer having those imports, imports of final goods that we buy at the grocery store, or imports of intermediate products that like the big auto companies use in their production. Then there's the counter or retaliatory tariffs, the tit for tat. So we impose a tariff, a trading partner imposes a tariff on our exports, hurting our manufacturing and production. And it's hard to see where that's going to go when you initiate such a trade war. And as I said earlier, in the past, these situations have rarely ended well.
And so we have American businesses that have a lot of Canadian customers that will then have to pay Canada a lot of money in order to sell their products in Canada.
That's exactly right. And this interesting corollary effect, apparently Canadians don't want to travel to the U.S. for tourism anymore. And apparently that this has really been shown in the air flights and other travel across the border. They're offended with the way things have been going. They don't want a vacation in Florida anymore. So again, there's all these kind of spin-off effects that are unintended.
Let me read this comment from Ross in South Philly, who says, if Americans start building better cars, I will consider buying one. Mm. For now, I'll keep my Toyota. And that brings me to sort of one of the larger questions here, Jonathan, which is, can we wean ourselves off of this reality that we can get pretty good products produced abroad pretty cheaply here in America? So let me read this quote. This is really interesting from Scott Bessent, who's now the Treasury Secretary, but he said this back in October before that was the case. Quote, while many economists pointed to the overall efficiency gains associated with this labor disruption, cheaper toys and televisions were little recompense for the loss of reliable earnings and the meaning that work brings to people's lives. This is really a question about what is prosperity, right? Mm. Is it having a job and the security of a job, or is it having the ability to buy lots of things that make your life more convenient, more enriching? I mean, how do you begin to answer that?
So I don't know that those two things are necessarily incompatible. Hmm. And I'm certainly very sympathetic with the sentiment, but I think it's difficult to turn the clocks backwards and try to revert to a simpler time and place. I think we are where we are, and we need to address the problems that are in front of us. And a big problem in the U.S. is that when we do have jobs that are displaced by trade or technology or something else, we're not very good at helping those workers get retrained. So I'd rather see us invest in actionable initiatives to try to help the disruption from trade, as opposed to this kind of willy-nilly application of tariffs to try to disrupt global economic relationships.
So what you're saying, look, this is the modern economy. It's going to happen. There's going to be displacement, whether by trade or technology, maybe both. You have to just find ways to make the change hurt less.
Yes. And in particular, the North American economy, as I mentioned earlier, is so deeply integrated, it's hard to see how we would reverse that process. With respect to relationships with other countries around the world, I'm sympathetic with tariffs on Chinese imports because China plays by a different set of rules than many other countries around the world. So I'm not opposed to tariffs if they're used strategically and with a purpose in mind. I'm skeptical of them if they're imposed for unclear reasons and they are already having these corollary effects in prices and financial markets, by the way, as well. We've seen a lot of that in the last couple of weeks.
That was Jonathan Doe, professor of international business at Villanova and a former official at the U.S. Department of Commerce. We'll have more with him on the other side of this break. We'll have more from you. And we're bringing in a special guest, a local business person who can talk about, you know, the personal effect of these tariffs. Stick with us. You are listening to Studio 2.
Welcome back to Studio 2. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. If you are just joining us, we're talking about the pros and cons of President Trump's tariff policies, and we're talking about the pros and cons of really free trade in general. In the studio with us is Jonathan Doe, professor of international business at Villanova and a former Commerce Department official.
And we want to hear your answers to our questions of the day, listeners. Would you be willing to pay more for goods like cars, groceries, electronics, if it would bring more jobs back to America in the long run? Or is Or is it all just too much? Give us a call, 888-477-9499. You can email studio2@whyy.org. And if you're watching on YouTube, be sure to drop your comment on the chat.
So we've been talking about things in the abstract. Now it's time to get real with our next guest to the program. Brian Zelliga is the owner of Fishtown Seafood, and he says that domestic aqua farming at its current state cannot make up for the loss of seafood imported from Mexico. So, Brian, welcome to Studio 2. Brian, are you with us?
All right.
All right, we'll wait for Brian. In the meantime, actually, I had another question teed up, Jonathan Doe, because I wanted – this is actually – a really great comment, great listeners, by the way, from Rob, who says, the question posed seems to be, would we be willing to pay more for goods manufactured here to provide more and better jobs, et cetera, et cetera? But, Rob says, would investors in the construction of new factories and the refurbishing of old ones not be more likely to spend their capital on the installation of AI and robotics rather than on providing old technology jobs for our workers? Is that the most likely outcome?
I think there's something to be said that.
Yeah.
We talked earlier about the fact that technology does have a way of displacing workers over time. Ideally, those workers are able to do something else or their successors are able to do something else. But yeah, it's not clear that building more factories is going to significantly increase employment because they are so automated these days. So I think the listener has a good point.
Mm. Yeah. I want to go ahead and bring in Brian Zelliga, of Fishtown Seafood. He's been on the line. Brian, welcome to Studio 2.
Thank you for having me.
So, Brian, I want to get right to it. How have these tariffs already been affecting your ability to stock and sell seafood? What's the impact on you and your business?
Yeah, so the on and on, off again has been very, very difficult over the last several months. So it's been difficult kind of figuring out where pricing is going to be, what availability is going to be, and what our wholesale customers, what's going to be on their menu. So it's been extremely challenging. And even as of this morning, we have oysters coming in from Canada that are on the menu of a local restaurant. And we're not sure what that pricing is even going to be based on does it cross the border at before or after midnight tonight. So it's extremely challenging, especially for a capital intensive business like seafood and for a small and growing business, it's extremely hard and extremely difficult. You know, I'm not equipped to really deal with these global economic events.
Yeah, no kidding. Nor are we, Brian, and we sympathize with you entirely. I think some people might be wondering, so you mentioned oysters coming in from Canada. Hey, there are oysters here in America. Like, why couldn't your supplier shift to American farmed caught oysters? Like, take us inside that dilemma for someone running your particular business.
Absolutely. There are lots of factors to unpack there. One, oysters are a growing product, growing demand. So in 2022, I believe it was the first time since they started the list that oysters entered the top 10 most consumed seafood list at number 10. So Americans are eating more and more oysters.
Lots of consumption.
To put that in perspective, you know, in 1880 through Philadelphia alone, there were 800 million oysters passed through Philadelphia on a wholesale level. Right now, currently in Philadelphia, nowhere near even New York, Philadelphia, D.C., there's not that many oysters going into these markets today in 2025. So it's a item that we used to consume a lot of due to habitat, freshwater issues, over-harvesting, product went down, and now it's been on the rebound. And currently there's not enough, as it's a growing product, there's not enough domestic product to just fill the complete demand. So it takes a long time to grow an oyster. It can take up to 3 years or more to make an oyster market ready. So it's not as simple as turning the switch and just saying we can have more domestic oysters.
And I got to ask you this, Brian. So you sell a number of seafood items. So what would happen to your business if the costs just skyrocket? What does it do to you specifically in your business?
Well, I think, you know, we'll see what happens over time. But it's pretty complicated because seafood is already kind of viewed as a premium priced product, right? So if prices go up, and depends on what what expendable cash flow people have, and are they able to spend more money on what is already viewed as a premium priced product. So, I mean, I don't have any products in my shop that cost $1.99 a pound, like a cheap skinless, boneless chicken breast can when it's on sale at a traditional grocery store. So customer perception of seafood being a higher cost item is a potential big challenge for our business.
Yeah, so people might say, I'll skip the fish.
The shrimp. Yeah, I love shrimp.
That's Brian Zelliga, owner of Fishtown Seafood. Real quick, you wanted to do a closing comment there, Brian?
Oh, and I was just going to say, you know, on the flip side of that is seafood is at a discount right now because it's not experienced the same amount of inflation as eggs and chicken and other products.
So that advantage might go away. That's Brian Zelliga, owner of Fishtown Seafood. Thank you so much for your time.
Yeah, and I wanted to thank you so much. And so I wanted to ask you a question, Jonathan, just sort of what kind of policies could the Trump administration put into effect that would help ease the short-term pain? Because the president has said, look, this is going to hurt. But it doesn't seem to me to be anything to help people deal with that hurt as they try to get us off the sauce, like we said earlier, of imported goods.
So in the first Trump administration, there were tariffs applied to a number of different products, including farm products. And there was a special subsidy program that was initiated to try to compensate those farmers for their lost exports because they were facing these retaliatory tariffs as a result of our imposition of tariffs. So there are different subsidies that the government could offer. They could lower certain forms of taxes. But those strategies are unlikely to fully mitigate the impact of these tariffs.
Yeah, because we hear what Brian's talking about, and I'm just thinking are there government efforts that could sort of ease this burden that's going to be on car dealerships, that's going to be on manufacturers like this, store owners? And it seems like there's no plan for that part.
Not clear to date if there's any particular plan. There is discussion again about perhaps subsidizing farmers for the hit that they may take, because what happens is our trading partners are very strategic about how they retaliate in terms of their tariffs. They pick particular parts of the country that they think are politically vulnerable, like Kentucky bourbon or Harley-Davidson motorcycles, or farm products from the Midwest. And so in the previous administration, there were efforts to try to compensate or mitigate some of those effects. I wanted to mention something else, if you don't mind.
Yeah.
And that is that when we put high tariffs on raw commodities of imports, it affects the competitiveness of our producers. I'll give you two examples. Our sugar tariffs are quite high, and so sugar that we buy here is about twice the global market. What that means is that candy producers have all but vacated the U.S. It's too expensive to make candy in the U.S. because sugar is too expensive.
Yeah.
Steel tariffs. We increased steel tariffs in the first Trump administration, and we've often had steel tariffs in the past. Prices go up. And that hurts our auto producers because they're looking to keep their cost under
control.
This
is the downstream effect, especially when you're talking about raw materials tariffs. But let me ask you before we get out of here, I want to read in this comment on YouTube from Ballet Boy. And we're going to get probably a little bit outside of your bailiwick with this one. But Ballet Boy says, I'm worried these tariffs and Trump's stances on foreign policy and financial pause to the World Trade Organization will push America further into isolation. Which brings me to this, Jonathan Doe. Does trade war cause actual war? When people retreat from their economic relationships, does that increase the possibility of actual conflict?
I'm going to answer your question indirectly.
Okay.
One of the reasons that we had the European Community, which was the group of European countries coming together to free trade and commerce between them, and ultimately the European Union, was to try to prevent another pan-European war.
Yeah, which seemed to happen all the time before
that.
So
there is evidence that when we do business with each other, when we have economic integration, when we rely economically on each other, we're less likely to have other kinds of conflicts. And so there is some kind of correlation between trade war and other kind of war.
I want to mention this comment from YouTube from Judy, who says, yes, I would pay more if it would bring back well-paying jobs to the U.S. And as we wrap up, I just wonder, could this work? Many people say that it will not work. These tariffs will not bring American jobs. What is your take?
My take is that the way that they've been announced and imposed so far is unlikely to do that because it's two steps forward, one step back. There's been a lot of volatility, some would even say chaos, in the way this tariff approach has unfolded. If we were to strategically think about tariffs in limited ways as strategies to try to bring back investment that we may have lost in the past, that could work. That's not what I see happening right here.
That was Jonathan Doe, professor of international business at Villanova and a former official at the U.S. Department of Commerce. Great insight this hour. Thanks for being here.
Thanks,
in studio
Terry.
Thanks,
Terry.
Yes, and thank you to our producers, Debbie Builder, Paige Mary Besser, and Andreas Copes. Thanks to Mike Schiffler, our visual producer, and the Outbanks, and Tina Kalake, who engineered today's show. Our executive producer is Kevin McCrory from Studio 2 at WHYY Philadelphia. I'm Cherry Gregg. You can't just read the script.
Yeah, I know. That was almost a Ron Burgundy moment. You almost read it word for word. Every once in a while, an old script gets into the new script. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. You are listening to Studio 2 on WHYY. We'll talk to you again tomorrow.